Welcome back, everyone, to Progressively Incorrect. My name is Zach Groeschel, and I am here with Marcy Samayoa, and we're going to be talking all about science education and cognitive science. I'm really excited to talk to Marcy in just a moment, but before we kind of jump in talking about all the controversies that surround science education, let's take a moment to think about our sponsors. The first sponsor, of course, is John Cat Educational by Hachette Learning. They provide lots of support to me in terms of getting my book out there, which is Just Tell Them the Power of Explanations and Explicit Teaching. So check out the show notes for their entire catalog and get yourself started on the evidence-based learning journey. Get yourself some books. Also wanted to mention StepLab. I'm the director of StepLab North America, and we provide lots of support to schools and coaches. We want to make coaching systematic. And so we have a platform that helps coaches to do that based on the science of learning. Go ahead and check out the show notes for StepLab. And Marcy, how are you doing?
Hello, Zach. I'm doing well. It's 8:30 a.m. right now. And I'm just waking up.
Well, and you're coming from my part of the world because normally I'm just waking up while everyone else is has had their day and their coffee already. It is also this that time for me. You're in L.A., correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, I am. And I just came from the Research Ed Conference in Denver just yesterday. So just, trying to catch up, trying to go back to my routines.
Nice. Well, maybe introduce yourself more fully. Like, what do you do? And why are you such an amazing person to follow? You don't need to answer that. But your blogs and your threads are absolutely amazing. And so, yeah, just tell us about yourself real quick.
Oh, well, thank you. My name is Marcy, and I am a chemistry teacher in Los Angeles, California. I have been in the classroom for the past 10 years. And throughout my education career, I have only worked at Title I schools. So I have worked with students with IEPs. I'm in LA, so we have a large English language learners population. I have also worked with gifted students. I just don't know how to say that because some people are like, are they gifted? But I have worked with gifted students. I have taught honors chemistry and AP chemistry throughout my teaching career as well. My teaching journey has just been so bumpy. And the reason for that is because when I first started teaching, I wasn't really familiar with the science of learning. And I didn't really get into it until the pandemic. And it's not for lack of interest. I've always been interested into research. I just never really had the time to look into it. And the pandemic, just trying to look at the silver lining here, gave me the time to do so. And it was completely jaw-dropping because this is all the information that I did not learn in my teaching credential program at all. I think they only mentioned cognitive science for, 5 minutes during a psychology course, and then we moved on. So during the pandemic, I read many books. One of them was Make It Stick. The other one was The Science of Learning, 99 Studies That Every Teacher Needs to Know by Bradley Bush. I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. Why Don't Students Like School by Daniel Willingham. And so this completely transformed my practice. And I thought no teacher should invest this much personal time, you know what I mean, to know this information. This information should have been taught at the teacher credential program. And so I thought, why not start a blog? That way teachers don't have to invest that much time because I already did it and they can learn a lot more quickly than I did. That way they don't have to go through the, that process. It was a very frustrating process, but I'm very glad I went through it though, because it has definitely improved my teaching practices for the better. So that's my journey with the Scientist in the Making blog.
Scientist in the Making. Okay. Everybody should check this blog out. It's in the show notes. It's a blog that I follow very closely. It helps me to keep tabs on like the subject that really gave me the most trouble in school. I usually say it was math because math, I had way more of it, obviously, but chemistry specifically, here is what happened to me in chemistry. I take biology. I love it. I'm like, this is my future. I love science. I can't even believe they've been withholding all this information from me. I can't, incredible stories about, and then just models and modeling on the document camera and talking through great things, reading books, reading textbooks and analyzing diagrams. we get to chemistry, and I think the same thing about like the animal kingdom is going to happen with chemistry. And all of a
Oh
sudden, I find out it's more freaking math.
Yes.
It's basically So maybe we could kind of dig into some of these things. Let's jump ahead just real quickly to talking about how you translate research from cognitive science into like daily practice. How do you get someone like me, a kid like me, on board with this? And how do you get them to learn this stuff when it's really complex?
Yeah, you know what? It's so funny that you mentioned that, Zach, like that transition from biology to chemistry, because a lot of my students took bio in ninth grade. And once they get me in 10th grade, they ask me, Miss, when are we going to be dissecting frogs? And I tell them, no, that's bio. This is chemistry. So I'm so glad that you bring that up. Yes, so chemistry is very difficult because not only is it very abstract, right? No one has ever seen the atom with the naked eye. Whereas in biology, you've seen leaves with the naked eye, you've seen animals with the naked eye. So it does make it a little bit easier to tie it to their prior knowledge. However, chemistry, well, that's a whole different beast. But the science of learning principles can definitely help mitigate that. So how do I translate that? Wow, I could write a whole book, but I'm going to try to summarize it. Well, first of all, it's how I present that information to the students. So during my first few years of teaching, I used to put a lot of information into slides, a lot. And I thought it was best, right? Because the more information, the better. And then I started learning about the multimedia principles. And Zach, you do such an amazing job describing these principles in your book, just letting you know. I learned that you need to chunk the information. You need to take into consideration the student's working memory and not cause cognitive overload. So when I do my lessons, I consciously think about those all the time, which is something that I didn't do before. So that's one. And just a few examples of the multimedia principles. You pair words with visuals, that's dual coding. I reduce cognitive load by keeping the slides and handouts clean and uncluttered. I segment the information. So honestly, that's something that I was not taught in my teacher credential program, which is insane now that I think about it. Now, as far as what the students do, lots of retrieval, lots and lots of retrieval. So I'm going to name a few. I do brain dumps with the students. So, as I'm presenting the information, we might pause and I might give them a prompt and tell them, okay, I want you to just tell me everything you know about this topic or about this question or blah, blah, blah. And the students do it without checking their resources because that's how we truly do retrieval. And then if I see that there's some gaps, we mediate that as well. Mini whiteboards. That is one of my favorites. You have to take away those mini whiteboards from my cold, dead hands because it has transformed my teaching, 100%. I use it for check for understandings all the time. So when I'm presenting the information, maybe I might pause and I might put a prompt up there and I might tell students, okay, I want you guys to write in your mini whiteboards the answer to this question. 3, 2, 1, go. And then they hover. And then I tell them, okay, put your boards up in 3, 2, 1, go. And it really allows me to see what their thinking process is at that time. Turn and talks, also one of my favorites, gives students a chance to explain the concepts. And the way I phrase it is, if you can explain it, then that means you understand it. And it also gives them a chance to practice their vocabulary. Another one is the Brain Book Buddy system that I learned from Blake Harvard. So this teaches students how to study on their own. And I love that because instead of using the notes as something that they need to reread, they use the notes as a resource to double check their answers after they do retrieval, which is amazing. And one of the new techniques that I'm using is phase reading. I hope I'm saying that correctly. I'm in the middle of reading The Science of Learning book, the new book by Doug Lemov. And I'm testing that right now, and it's actually going pretty well. So, again, I can go on, and I don't want to ramble, but those are the few strategies that I use in my classroom.
Love it. I love that you bring up the new Science of Reading book by Doug Lemov. I've got to get my hands on that book, by the way. So you have these kind of core practices. And one of the things I've been harping on in this podcast recently, especially with Gene Tabernetti, is like that you can have all of these isolated techniques that you're working on, and it's great. It's invigorating, trying new things. You see the success of students. But maybe you could walk us through how you put this together into a lesson or a unit, because without this glue or without this container, I feel like we are at risk of just like a lot of tips and tricks kind of type of teaching. But you've written about this, how you kind of see this going together. How do you put this into a lesson?
I had that problem, right? Because you're right. There were like a lot of tips and tricks, and it was a constant frustration with me. I'm like, how do I put this together? And it was different for each topic. And then I read Jean's book. I read a lot of books. I read Jean's book, Teach Fast, and I was so happy with it because for the first time, someone is explaining how to put all this together into one cohesive lesson plan. So I'm gonna try to provide an example, and I teach chemistry, so I'm gonna try to keep it as simple as I can. So in chemistry, one concept that students struggle with a lot is molarity. And the reason why is because one, it's abstract. Two, it in involves math. And three, it's just something that they've never seen before. And so I used his framework, so I'm just going to try to summarize it. Well, the first thing I did is I gave students a preview of the content by tying it to their everyday experience. So I tied molarity with Kool-Aid. Now, for people who don't know what molarity is, it's just the amount of a substance in a liquid. I think that's the most simple way I can explain it. So I used Kool-Aid. I gave them a picture of different Kool-Aid, and I asked them which one is the sweetest one. And so what this does is that this ties the chemistry to their prior knowledge, to their everyday experiences. And so, students answer it. And then I go over the learning objective where I tell them, okay, today, obviously it's a lot more specific. I just can't remember off the top of my head, but I tell them today we're going to learn how to calculate molarity. Keeping it simple, that's just the one new thing we are learning. Afterwards, I have them do retrieval because what I have done at that moment in time is that I already taught them how to do some of the calculations. Now, one lethal mutation I see teachers do, actually, this was what my presentation was on. One lethal mutation that students do is, sorry, not students, teachers do, is they tell students the information, they don't ask students to retrieve it. And so, what I do is I ask students questions like, how do you calculate this? What is the definition of this? Et cetera, et cetera. It's all content from previous lessons. And the reason why I'm having students recall them today is that way they can see how that connects to today's lesson. So, we do retrieval, and sometimes we use the BrainBook Buddy system for that. And then afterwards, I model. So, I model with the think aloud, I show them step by step how to calculate molarity. After that, they use their mini whiteboards, and this is where it's very important. And Gene emphasizes this in his book. When students are doing guided practice, do it one step at a time instead of having students solve the whole problem. So instead of telling students, okay, I want you to solve this molarity problem right now, instead, what I tell them is, okay, I want everybody to do step one of this problem on the mini whiteboard. Okay, three, two, one, go. And so by doing it step by step, it allows me to catch exactly which step my students are struggling in. So instead of going over the whole problem repeatedly over and over, I just focus my attention on what students are struggling in. So for example, if I have them do step two and I see that 50% of my students are struggling, then that's the time that I go over it. And I tell them, okay, I see this common mistake. Let's go over it one more time and let's try to fix it. And then we do step two again just to make sure that students are fixing their mistakes. Now, if they get step three correct, everybody gets step three, I just move on. Now, there is always going to be one or two students that are not going to get it. But instead of stopping and giving them intervention in that moment, I just keep going. And I'll go over that later on. I don't give them intervention until students do independent practice. So after the mini whiteboards, we check for understanding. Maybe we did a few turn-in talks. What I do afterwards is, okay, here's some independent practice problems. I want you to do them. During that time, I pull one or two students out, the ones that really struggled throughout the whiteboard process, and I give them one-on-one intervention. And it has been so helpful for students with IEPs, students who are English language learners. It gives me the time to give them that one-on-one attention, but without stopping the lesson in the middle, if that makes sense, without ruining the
The
flow, I
flow,
guess.
man. I find this really important that you explain this, because in explicit instruction, each of those steps that you named have there are certain assumptions about why you're doing that, because they connect to other things that are going to happen in this system. And so without this system, or without so the container for all of the tips and tricks, then they just become tips and tricks. And you start to, I imagine some people would abandon some of them. Well, when we do retrieval, my kids don't really like it. They find it really effortful. Where is your retrieval situated in the bigger scheme of things, so that you can make sure it's also high success? You can make sure that it's pertinent to the learning they're doing very soon, so there's a motivational aspect. All of what you just described, we can't just talk about the parts without referring to the whole, is what I'm trying to say.
Yes, I mean, obviously, there's a time and a place for retrieval. You don't want to ask them too soon because then students won't know what to write down. But you also don't want to wait too long because then that causes cognitive overload. So I think with experience, you just have to check, okay, which is like the sweet spot in asking them for retrieval. And I think seeing other teachers do these practices is also helpful. I read Teach Like a Champion. And I see a bunch of videos on there. And it's one thing to read about it, but it's another thing to see how it's implemented in the classroom, which I'm very grateful for. I also see some teaching videos on the Twitter platform, teachers implementing these principles. And that's actually really helpful too. So I think for teachers, it's not just reading it, but seeing it in practice. And getting feedback from, I don't know, instructional coaches or maybe other teachers on how to perfect their craft.
You recently filmed yourself doing a lesson. I'm pretty sure you based some of those steps on watching Pritesh Raiachura and
Yes.
his kind of in the Steplob documentary, right? I felt that was very brave of you to do so. Maybe kind of go through some of those things, because I was sitting there taking notes over here as I watched these videos.
Well, okay, yes, I did see Pritesh's video in the StepLab documentary. By the way, I watched the whole thing. I mean, I'm a teacher nerd. It is what it is. I loved it, absolutely loved it. And one comment that I saw on the Twitter platform when he posted it, which was very brave of him too, is they said, there's no way that this can be done in a Title I school. There's no way that this can be done in the US. And so I remember doing a thread telling them, actually, you can. Students love knowing stuff. I always say this in every podcast that I'm in. Students love knowing stuff. And if they know it, they're going to be more motivated to do the other activities that you have planned. So, obviously, I got a lot of I got a lot of encouraging feedback from that, and also a lot of negative feedback from that. They're like, "No, you don't know." I guess they don't know my background. They tell me, "Oh, you don't teach at a Title I school, so you will never know." Which is funny because I've been teaching Title I my whole teaching career. So not only in a charter school setting, but in a public, like in a public school setting as well. So I wanted to, not just talk the talk, but walk the walk. So I decided, you know what? I'm gonna film myself in a Title I school and I'm gonna show everybody that this can be done. And yeah, I put in my own little twist to it. I posted the questions up on the smart board. That way students can remember what questions I'm asking them. I also gave them a little bit of thinking time. That way they know what to tell their partners when we do a turn and talk, or that way they know what to say when we do a call response. And I loved it. You can hear when students do the turn and talk, you can hear them being engaged. You can hear them laughing. Okay, because it's an enjoyable experience knowing things. And yeah, I just wanted to show that to everybody that it is totally possible in the US and in a Title I school.
I'm the same way, in which I'm proud to have worked in the school that nobody else wanted to work in,
Yes.
right? I'm proud to be in the school that we were just shedding teachers every year, and I stuck around despite all the change and all the behavior and all the violence against teachers. And yet, the same thing happens to me and to everyone else in these situations, is that the profession itself, swears that nothing works anywhere that they work, and that especially the techniques that we've gravitated towards because they work with the most challenging kids, that those don't work with the most challenging kids. It drives me nuts. Like, maybe do you have a response? Because you also get a lot of this abuse online when you post anything. It just drives me nuts.
Well, I would say that the students that come from disadvantaged backgrounds that don't have as much background knowledge as they should at a certain grade level, they're the ones that benefit most from explicit instruction. And I know this because explicit instruction is actually somewhat celebrated in the special education section. Right? They tell them, okay, so for these kids, we need to break it down into steps. We need to do this, we need to do that. And I look at it and I'm like, well, that's just explicit instruction. And it benefits everyone, right? And not only that, I really want to bring this up. It also saves teachers time. Because often when we bring up that we have a diverse student population in the classroom, they tell us to differentiate. Oh, differentiate, differentiate, differentiate. Well, what does that mean? And some teachers interpret that as, oh, I need to make five different versions of the same lesson, which no one has the time for. And also, it's not very effective. You can't be teaching five different lessons in one setting and think that it's going to be successful. It's not. But if you use explicit instruction, it benefits everybody. It benefits students with IEPs. It benefits students, English language learners. The phase reading, by the way, for my English language learners, I just want to throw that in there. Amazing. They're learning vocabulary words. They're learning how to read in English. It's awesome. And then, yeah, even for the gifted students as well, because even for chemistry, they find the subject difficult, right? So me being able to break down those concepts benefits everyone, and I do have the test scores to prove it. It's funny. One time, admin pulled me to the side, and I thought I was in trouble because I'm very outspoken, by the way. So I've gotten in trouble a few times. But anyway, they pull me to the side, and I'm like, oh man, what did I do this time? So they tell me, oh Marcy, we just want to talk about your test scores. Like, what are you doing? And I have good rapport with them. So as a joke, I said, I do the opposite of what you tell me. And then they go like, no, Marcy, like seriously, what do you do? And I tell them, honestly, I use explicit instruction, which is, I know it doesn't go exactly by the NGSS standards, but I do find a way to tie them in there. And it's been helping everybody. So I don't understand why no one else is doing it. It drives me insane because don't you want to see your students succeed? Don't you want your students to not be frustrated? Don't you want your students to be excited to come into class? I get that feedback all the time from the students. They're like, Miss, this is my favorite class. And I don't do anything crazy. I'm not dancing in front of them. I'm not doing a TikTok dance, right? I'm not doing any of those, stuff. I'm just teaching, and the kids love it because they're learning. It's really that simple.
Well, and I think that that kind of brings us to kind of misconceptions in science, because clearly the scientific method or the process is an inquiry process that you undergo as a scientist or as an expert. And so what's happened in science in particular, but it's in every subject, regardless. That's the topic of this entire podcast, right? Is that because scientists use an inquiry process, the way that we teach science should mimic that inquiry process is how a lot of these standards are interpreted. The NGSS just happens to be the most famous, but it's similar in other sort of statewide adoptions of different standards or textbooks where the standards encourage the kids to construct knowledge on the basis of their own personal inquiries rather than an external source delivering information explicitly. How do you manage that expectation while also being sort of true to the subject and so on? I'm very curious about this.
Okay, so I'm so glad we bring up the misconception. So I've actually spoken to some of the people that wrote the NGSS standards. Now, I'm not going to put out any names, but it was part of the PD training that we did. And so their reasoning is the same, the thing that you stated, that if the experts study science this way, then the kids should too. But that's a misconception because scientists are experts in their field. They took years to build the knowledge that they have in their brains. They didn't discover it. They got that knowledge from school. They got it in high school. They got it in college. And in college, we all know it's lecture-based. So we all know that they didn't discover it. And it just took years of practice. Now, compare that with students, a 10th grade student. I mean, some of these kids are grade levels behind, right? Or some of these kids, their only exposure to science was biology. So we can't even remotely compare those two. How experts learn and how novices learn are completely different. Experts learn through inquiry because they have no more to learn, right? They have the foundational knowledge. So the only way to push that forward is through inquiry. Whereas students, well, they still have all this information that they need to learn. One example that I always provide to make, my argument is if I do a demonstration, for example, of a chemical change, and let's say I do a little experiment and it changes color. If I ask an expert, what's happening here? Well, they will tell you, well, bonds are being broken, like they're breaking, and new bonds are being formed, and therefore we're forming new substances. Okay. If you ask a student what's happening, they're like, oh, it's so cool, it turned red. It's very surface level knowledge. The reason why they can't get there to where the scientist is at is because they don't have the knowledge to do so. So the fact that we think that they can get there through discovery is just, I think, is absolutely ridiculous. Especially with such an abstract and complicated topic as chemistry. So how do I go about that? Well, I have to do my job and I do have to abide by the NGSS standards. So I don't see explicit and inquiry as complete opposites. What I see them as two parts of the same process. So the mistake is when inquiry comes too early. Right. So if it comes to early, students don't have the foundation to apply that knowledge in order to do that high order thinking that we want them to do. So instead, I front load the information with explicit instruction with the same strategies that I said previously. I teach them the vocabulary, I teach them the concepts, I teach them the procedures. And then once students have that base, then I lead them to inquiry. So one example that I posted on Twitter, I posted it as a thread, is when I had them do the Socratic seminar. When I first told students that we were going to do a Socratic seminar, they all groaned. Ugh, we always do that in so-and-so class. I don't like it, blah, blah, blah. Right? And I told them, look, give me a chance and we'll see how this goes. So what I did is I started with explicit instruction. The Socratic seminar was supposed to be about the urban heat island effect. So that's what we did. I explicitly taught them that. I taught them the vocabulary through flashcards. I taught them the concepts through brain dumps and concept maps and et cetera, et cetera. And then afterwards, I put them into groups and I told them, okay, now I want you to find solutions to mitigate the urban heat island effect in California, because we're in California. So how do we do that? And so you should have heard their discussions. It was so rich in vocabulary because they knew it already. So one, I remember one kid mentioned, we should plant more trees in California because, they go through evapotranspiration and that cools the city. And then another kid said, well, what about the cement? Like, what if we make it white? Is it going to change its specific heat capacity? Like, they sounded like scientists because I gave them the foundations to do so. And they thought of solutions that I never even considered. For example, when one kid said, we should plant more trees, another kid said, but we live in California and we experience droughts all the time. Do we have enough water to plant and take care of these trees? And then another student mentioned, oh, we just had a wildfire, that crazy Los Angeles wildfire that we had. They're like, we just had a wildfire. Do you think it's wise to incorporate more trees? What if we find a different solution? Anyway, the point that I'm trying to make is they were able to get there because I gave them the foundational knowledge to do so. And so when we finally put all the groups together and did the Socratic seminar, it was absolutely beautiful. And I wish I could share that recording. I did record it for the teachers in my school, but I can't post that on Twitter because of privacy reasons, but it was absolutely amazing. And the kids enjoyed it. So remember when I said, when I told the students, oh, we're going to do a Socratic seminar and they all groaned, they're like, oh, I don't want to do it. because they had the foundational knowledge, they had fun and they were so involved and they were really into it. And it was, and at the end, they're like, Miss, can we do another one? Can we do another Socratic seminar? And it was because they had the foundational knowledge. You know, often when I tell teachers that they need the foundations, they go, but that's a low order thinking skill. We want them to do the high order thinking skill. And they take out the Bloom's taxonomy, right? The Bloom's taxonomy pyramid. And I'm sarcastic sometimes. So I tell them, do you know how pyramids work? You need the foundation. Like the pyramid can't stand without the foundation. So yeah, those are the common misconceptions, and that's how I address them.
It's interesting. I have a parallel story in which I was in a history class and we were supposed to like argue about like I guess half of us were like the oil company and the other half of us were like the native tribe that like in the Amazon or something that was like deciding whether or not to give up their the rights to their land to the oil company or whatever. And it just ended up being more about who could act and be louder. Kind of more of a BSer in that kind of situation. You know, it became more about like who's confident and can act than who has the most knowledge about this actual topic. And we're just making stuff up. And so much of teaching could just be fixed if we got rid of that entire idea that you jump to the higher order because that's what the kids deserve or something. And we think about the motivational aspects that you just said of knowing something enabling you to perform effortlessly with it sometimes. I think that's such a good point. There's another thing about science that I've brought this up before in previous episodes, but I'm curious how you do labs or practicals or hands-on type of things, knowing that there's an element of it's necessary at times to do these type of activities, and yet in my experience they can go horribly wrong where one kid is essentially doing all the work for the other three, right?
You know, it's funny because whenever science teachers do labs, you see them walking out at the end of the day and they're completely exhausted. And that's because students are asking a million questions when they're doing a lab. Wait, where do we throw this? Wait, what do we do? Wait, what equipment? Oh, what's that equipment called? And can you imagine 20 of those students coming up to you asking the same question for, I don't know, period, like certain periods? It's just, it's exhausting. But I don't experience that anymore because I explicitly teach them the lab procedures. Well, first of all, I explicitly teach them the content, and then I explicitly teach them the lab procedures. Now, how do I go about this? So, the first thing I do is I teach them what the names of the lab equipment are. This is an Erlenmeyer flask. This is a beaker. And we practice that through flashcards, and I have them study with a partner. You need to know the names of this lab equipment because if you're reading the lab procedures and you don't know the names of this lab equipment and the lab procedures are stating those names, you're going to experience cognitive overload, right? Because you're like, wait, what's a beaker again? Wait, what's a graduated cylinder again? We don't want students to experience that. So I teach them the lab equipment first. Afterwards, for the procedure, I use the dual coding theory. So I give them the procedures, I give them the steps, and they're supposed to show me an image as to what that looks like. For example, if it says measure water using a graduated cylinder, they need to either draw a picture of that or they need to show, or we could do it online to save time. And yeah, I use the dual coding theory to experience that. And then we use the mini whiteboards just to double check afterwards. Right? I'm like, okay, let's see if you understood what's the first step. So let's say I did this. Is this correct? Blah, blah, blah. So I use the mini whiteboards for that just to double check. And then afterwards, I'm very structured. So before we do the lab, I give each of them a role. So here's a role. You as a group have to decide who's going to do what, but I want you to write their names. So for example, if you're going to be the one measuring water with the graduated cylinder, put your name next to that step. And I want you guys to decide that as a group before we start the lab. And so they do that. So, and then we go over the cleanup procedures. And then I tell them, everybody has their own role as to how to clean up. For example, if you're going to be the one responsible throwing away the filter paper, I want you to put your name next to that. Put your name. You cannot start the lab until that is done. And so, you know, I double check. And afterwards, they start. They do it on their own. I know. I know other science teachers do it differently. Maybe they do it step with step by them. I don't. I let them do it on their own, and it goes successfully. I don't have to intervene. I just stand back and just look. I actually look very much forward to the lab days because I just sit back and watch. Just for their safety, of course, because you don't want them to, hurt themselves. But no, normally nothing happens. And they do the lab well, and their discussions, okay, as they're doing the lab, it sounds scientific because, again, I gave them the foundational knowledge to do so. It's so funny. I give them we did a flame test just last week, and you should have heard their conversations. They're like, oh, it's going from ground state to excited state back to ground state. And it's releasing a lot of energy because it's giving us a high energy color. And it's just, they won't be able to do that if I didn't give them the foundations in the first place. So, me personally, I don't have a problem with labs. I actually walk out very well rested.
Like now that I'm hearing this, it's like it. I think a lot of us got into education because we wanted to see that lab occur. We wanted to we wanted to be the person who gave students those experiences. Like me, it started in summer camp, realizing like when you saw those aha moments or just that joy of discovery when the kids like picked up a starfish and like and realized that their fingers were stuck to it and you just and like isn't the world cool and you get into it and but then you find out like you said something that's kind of unpleasant, which is that it needs to be far more structured, especially at the beginning of the year, and there's times where I need to rein the whole all the behaviors in and we need to try it again and things that are uncomfortable to do because you're taking them away from their experience. But I don't know. You've embraced it. So it just sounds, it sounds like we're both preaching to the choir. You mentioned the other science teachers that perhaps they feel like they need to do the whole thing themselves, or they give everybody the chance to do it and then it goes so poorly. They start excluding kids from the experience and it's awful and they're tired. Just seems like you found a middle ground is the thing. I think it's great.
Can I add to that? So we talk about behaviors a lot. Explicit instruction really took care of a lot of the misbehavior. This is not all the time. Sometimes, they have their personal problems and they take it out on the teacher. I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but a lot of the time students misbehave because they don't know what's going on, right? So if you give them a lab and they have no idea how to approach it, guess what? They're going to start fooling around because they're bored. And they're going to be like, well, I don't know what to do. So let's just try this. And it becomes hectic. And then now the teacher has a power struggle because now, for safety reasons, they have to kick the kid out of the classroom, right? They're like, hey, we're working with fire. You're horsing around. I need you to go outside because I can't have you horsing around. You're compromising everybody else's safety. But now you have this tension between the student and the teacher, which is getting in the way of the student relationships, right? However, what if it's really structured? What if you gave them the foundational knowledge to do it? It goes smoothly. The students enjoy the lab. They enjoy the science, right? So they get enjoyment out of it. They're behaving because they know what comes next. They know what to do afterwards, right? Because I took the time to do that. I mean, I would be frustrated too if, I'm a science teacher, but if you put me in a group and told me, okay, talk about astrophysics. I don't know how to contribute to this conversation. I know nothing about it. I mean, maybe a few ideas here and there, but I'm not at expert level. So, like, I can just imagine how the kids feel when we do that. And again, I'm not going to state any names, but I do see a pattern where teachers that have less structure during labs are the ones that have the most problems with student behavior. So,
Absolutely.
again, it's just just structure it and you can solve, like, I would say, like 80% of the misbehavior you see in the classroom with explicit instruction. I mean, ever since I adopted it, I really don't have those problems. Maybe every once in a while, because again, students have personal problems and it is what it is. It's inevitable, but I definitely prevented a lot of fires from adopting explicit instruction. And that doesn't mean they don't do inquiry. Like I said before, we did the Socratic seminars, we do the labs. Sometimes we do use the scientific method, but because students have the knowledge and they have structure, it goes very smoothly. And I enjoy my job. I walk out enjoying my job because I'm like, students are learning, Right. So it's not just on the students enjoying the process, it's the teacher too. And honestly, I think that's one of the main reasons for teacher shortages. We're not teaching teachers how to teach. So they get frustrated. Students get frustrated. There's a bad student-teacher relationship there. And so the teacher just ends up quitting, right? Because their goal was for students to learn, but they're not learning. So, I mean, I don't blame them. I would quit too. You know, if it wasn't for my passion of teaching, I would have quit a long time ago.
And there's this narrative of like the hard part or the big, great, important part is getting them to that final higher order performance. And that's the part that's really rich, and that's what a great teacher does. And we're neglecting the same thing with kids. The fundamentals of teaching are being forgotten, where you have teachers who've taught for many years and can't teach a vocabulary word because their training is not focused on that. Assigning something is so easy in comparison, right? Hey, I've run a birthday party before. Everybody, go out and find these things I hid around the room, right? Those are so simple to run because you just say 3, 2, 1, go, right? It's way harder to have everyone attending to you for just that brief 15 minutes and make sure everybody, through a series of examples and non-examples, can construct their own sentence with a word in that short amount of time. We have to focus more on it.
Yes, and honestly, because it's not easy. It's not easy, especially if teachers don't have the curriculum, right? In order to implement explicit instruction well. You know, I've had to do it from scratch. I'm gonna be honest. Well, not from scratch, but you know, like most of it is my own. I don't have a textbook telling me, okay, at this minute, this is when you ask for turn and talk. I had to figure it out on my own through trial and error, and it's exhausting. Now, I've been doing this for 10 years, so it's gotten easier, but I cannot imagine a brand new teacher who had no training on this in the teacher credential program, and all of a sudden, you know, put them and throw them in the classroom and go like, good luck, right? We're putting teachers through INGRE, like just learn as you go. And it's personally, that's a frustrating process. I wish someone told me, hey, this is what we do. Let's practice it. I'm going to give you some feedback. Let's practice it again. Oh my goodness, that would have been so much easier.
Well, I want to give you a chance as we close to kind of suggest any of your blogs or books or resources that you think science educators in particular, but all teachers that are listening in who have just sort of caught the bug on the science of learning, where can they go to kind of continue on with their journey and to be able to keep following you as you learn new things?
Okay, well, my blog is www.scientistinthemaking.com. You can find all the resources there. I do tend to focus more on science instruction, but because these principles apply to everyone, all teachers are welcome. I think all teachers can benefit from it. You can also follow me on Twitter slash X, whatever you call it, at Sci in the Making. I post a lot of threads there in case people don't have time to read blogs. I post threads. And a few books that I recommend. I do recommend Adam Boxer's book, Teaching Secondary Science. I hope I got that title correct, but I love that book. Love that book. It really breaks it down as to how we can incorporate explicit instruction in the science classroom, which there's not many resources on that. So if you're interested in it, please check out Adam Boxer's book. And if you want to know the general principles as to how to present information, I recommend everybody check out Zach Rochelle's book. I love that book because it's short. It like you can read it in a day and it's so easy to reference. I reference it all the time. So highly recommend that too. And I'm not just saying that because I'm on this podcast, okay? Really recommend that book. Yes.
Excellent. Well, Marcy, it was a wonderful to catch up with you. I can't wait to have you back on when, like, in a few years, when, like, we've changed the world and we're just trying to figure out the next steps. Marcy, thank you so much for coming on. Listeners, please share this with a principal or a friend or a colleague. Get Progressively Incorrect out there and help by putting a 5-star rating on the platform of your choosing to sort of get this information to teachers. It's definitely in a pocket right now, and we'd love for more people to realize you can be invigorated and inspired by following the evidence and looking at how kids learn. Thank you so much, Marcy. Take care.
No problem, Zach. I'll see you later.